This episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast is presented by Sling. For the latest soccer action this week, we've got the CONCACAF Champions League match midweek on Tuesday, LAFC against Philadelphia Union. Of course, there is Arsenal against Chelsea in the Premier League on Tuesday too. Wednesday too, you've got action from the Premier League and Champions League also. So if you do want to watch any of these games, check out sling.com. Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast. My name is Christopher Harris. I am joined by my co-host, Kartik Krishnayar. Kartik, this is a topic that comes up probably every 12 months, especially so, talking about relegation towards the end of the European season, as well as promotion, of course. But did you know that automatic promotion and relegation started in the late 1890s in England? And what they did right before they did relegations, before that was a thing, between the first division and the second division, is they had test matches. So the bottom two teams in the first division and then the top two teams in the second division played test matches. And then based on the results of those games, then they'd figure out who'd go up and who'd go down. However, what happened was that in the first division, I think it was Stoke City and Blackburn colluded and figured out a way to kind of cheat the system. So after that, 1892, I think it was the first time that, or was it 1898? It was a long time ago, 1890s. That's when automatic promotion and relegation became a thing. So this is well over 100 years of history. What for you, Kartik, just to start off with, in terms of relegation specifically, which is what we're going to talk about today, a lot of big matches from this past weekend that have implications as well as this week, and not just the Premier League, but other leagues too. The Bundesliga, we saw a big game this past weekend between Schalke and Bremen, I think it was. Real nail-biter at the end. But what for you, what's the attraction to relegation specifically for you?
Well, first off, that 1890s, that is correct. There was also an election process that continued in the Football League for many years after that. So it wasn't always merit-based. I do want to point that out, because that will come up. I'm sure we will get feedback about that if I don't mention that. But it to me is the essence of football, right? Fighting for survival, fighting for your community. These are largely community-based clubs. You mentioned Schalke with that huge win over Bremen the other day. Bremen really not playing well of late, which is not necessarily good news considering they have Bayern next. Not good news for me. But Schalke, you see the fight in them since the winter break to get out of this relegation zone. They are a club that has more supporters than any other in Germany, with the exception of Dortmund and Bayern, and maybe Eintracht Frankfurt. They are a huge club. They are one of the historic clubs in Germany. And when they got relegated 2 years ago, it was a stunner. Remember, they had just finished second in the league a couple of years earlier. And now they've been in the relegation zone the entire season, but now are close to climbing out of it. Stuttgart has been winning a lot lately also, so that's affected them. But it affects communities. It creates a compelling product because the communities are so invested in these clubs, Chris, that you feel the angst in the crowd, right? You felt it in that Schalke Bremen match. You felt it in the Leicester Everton match today. We're recording this on Monday. And it's something that reminds us that football is very much about communities, supporters, local supporters, and basically living on knife's edge. It's not the glamour, for the most part, that you see from the Galacticos of Real Madrid and the oil money of Manchester City, etc. There's so much more to it, and I think relegation captivates that.
Yeah, when you think about it, relegation actually, we see that a lot more in regular life, right? So if you're in high school or college, if you fail your tests or fail your exams or fail that grade, you basically have to repeat that grade level again. You don't get promoted up to the next year or the next grade. You see that at work. If you're doing a really awful job at work, making mistakes and really poor performance, chances are you'll get laid off or you'll get fired. Those who do well get promoted up to, within the ranks or to a higher position. So it's something that, yes, in soccer specifically, it's something that many of us love, especially this time of the season too, because it's one of those things that, for me personally, I'm watching more of the relegation battles than I am the top of the table clashes. I'm trying to watch all of them as much as possible. But oftentimes I'm kind of looking at the relegation thinking, okay, that to me, for me personally, I find that even more exciting than the actual kind of title race or the race for Europe. Now, if you're a fan of one of those big six teams, that's a completely different story. But for me as a neutral, I'm attracted to that relegation battle. And Kartik, is there anything in American sports that's anything anywhere close to relegation as far as you know?
Not really, no. And I'm like you. I'm actually not that interested in the top of the table of most of these leagues. I mean, I watched Napoli yesterday. They kind of clinched. They didn't really, but I mean, it's going to take that point. It really helps them. Makes it almost impossible for Lazio to catch them. But other than that, I'm really captivated by relegation fights. We've got a major relegation battle in Spain. Also, we talked about Germany. We're talking about England. There's a real relegation fight going on at the bottom of the championship I've been writing about. So there's nothing like it in American sports. And when it comes to May, this seems to hold my interest more than title races or races for Europe, that sort of thing. Maybe that's just me. I can't think of anything offhand that's like it in American sports. Again, I do think there is a certain form of promotion and relegation within college sports, but it doesn't happen this dramatically. It kind of happens. It's kind of happened because of money more than anything, where some schools have ended up falling in from one conference to another based on just bad circumstances, whatever, market size, and then vice versa with some other schools. Here we have two schools in Florida, Florida Atlantic and University of Central Florida, that are sort of being promoted, quote unquote, this off season to bigger conferences, really because of the size of their universities. No, nothing else.
And for maybe the last five or 10 years, most of the final action in the Premier League is just as one example of a league. Most of the action, the final day action, basically based on those final day results. Usually, it's the relegation battle that comes down to the wire. And the title race and the qualification for Europe, usually by the end, it's already, we already know for the most part. The relegation battle this year, six teams in the running that could go down. So it is exciting. It is fascinating. And that's what we're going to talk about. Now, Kartik, those six teams, I have to include West Ham in this. I really feel that they're not out of the woods yet. But to me, it's West Ham, Leicester, Leeds United, Nottingham Forest, Everton and Southampton. Out of those six, which one do you think is performing the worst right now in terms of form?
That's a great question. They're all pretty lousy. West Ham is probably the best of those six. The other five are all performing poorly. I who's the worst of them? I mean, I would say probably Forest, but they did get that one victory in that period. But boy, they're all performing poorly. I mean, I think they all really, quite frankly, deserve to go down.
Hey, maybe we'll change it this season and have all six go down. To me personally, Leeds United by far is the worst team out of the six. And not just from this past Saturday, but from just like the last few weeks, especially even more so. They're not scoring goals. They're conceding a large number of goals, where they're losing 4-1, 5-1, 6-1. I look at this team and they're weak in defense. They have been for a long time. They're very weak, especially the center halves. The goalkeeper is suspect at times. Midfield is extremely poor. And they're really missing Tyler Adams. Weston McKennie is not up to grade. And to me, right now, the way he's playing, he's not a Premier League player. he's starting those games, but Leeds are devoid of a midfield. And up front, they're short on ideas, right? So Bamford's going through a really bad patch after coming back from injury. He's not match fit. He's fit as far as running around, but in terms of his sharpness, it's not there. So on and so forth. And Leeds, you look at the fans, you look at kind of the reaction, you look at the players. The players, it seems to be the way that they're playing, they're giving up. They're not putting it in 100%. As soon as they concede a goal or two, that's it. Heads are down. Marking is really poor. I mean, to me, Leeds are on, basically in a free fall. West Ham, West Ham, we could go through all of these. West Ham defensively are shambles. We saw that in that Crystal Palace game. They're so inconsistent. Forest, to me, though, Kartik, I think Forest shows glimmers of hope. I mean, even against Brentford, they were very unlucky. They've been really battered by some really tough injuries, kind of players out for the season, and have come so close in the last few games, where they have lost, to getting a point, or getting 3 points. So to me, I think they've been really unlucky. Everton looks good, though. I think Everton shows fight. Southampton shows fight. They don't have the points.
Yeah.
So what's your take on this? I mean, if you're looking at this bottom six, who do you feel right now, which I know it's really difficult, but who do you feel are going to go down?
Well, I mean, Forest have 5 points in their last 10 matches. So even if they might pass an eye test, they're not getting results. Southampton's next 3 matches are interesting because they've got Forest away. That's very difficult. But if somehow they got 3 points in that, let's not forget, they just got a point at Arsenal last week. So if they somehow beat that, won that match, they then have Fulham after. Fulham are all banged up now and, of course, have Mitrovic suspended. So that's a match you could win. And then at Brighton after that, Brighton's a side that I think are really hit or miss, and when they play poorly, it tends to be against lesser teams. I still think Southampton goes down. I think Leeds goes down. I agree with you. In addition to your point on Weston McKennie, which I completely agree with you, he does not look like a Premier League caliber midfielder. And quite honestly, there were times at Schalke he had these dips also. So and at Juventus, he was in and out of the team, right? So we've never consistently seen it from him over a long period of time in 3 different top leagues. So a jury's kind of out on him. Mark Rocha is a guy I'm really disappointed with, right? He's a guy I didn't think was a particularly good Bundesliga player. Thought it was a mistake by Jesse Marsch, who was familiar with him from Leipzig, to bring him over from the Red Bull system, and he hasn't worked out. So I say Leeds, Southampton, that third spot. I'm hoping it's not Everton, but they're not getting, they're battling. You're right. They're fighting, but today, I think they should have gotten all 3 points. Iversen with some great goalkeeping for Leicester, but still, Everton aren't getting the points they need. So I have to say it's probably going to be them. I mean, their results are not matching the performances. They should have won that match against Palace. They should have gotten more, I feel, out of the match against Spurs, where they were the better team. That was fairly recently. So they're not getting. They're not getting 3 points anywhere, and that's a real concern. So I think it's those 3. Leicester should go down, but I guess they won't. So when I say all 6 of those teams are bad, you might be right, Chris. Even though 5 points in 10 matches is terrible, Forest is the second least poor of that 6 that you mentioned. So yeah, I'm with you. They'll stay up. I think Leicester should go down, but snatching a point today, maybe in my opinion, kind of an undeserved point, that might save them.
Yeah, West Ham, I mentioned before too that they're not out of the woods yet. But you look at West Ham's fixtures for the rest of the season. They play Man City away midweek in one of the catch-up games. So Man City away. Then they play Man United at home. Then they play Brentford away. And then the last 2 games are going to be like crunch matches for those bottom 6 teams. But the last 2 matches for West Ham are Leeds at home and then Leicester away. So West Ham United could... you know, have a, be a major factor in who stays up, who goes down, including themselves in this one too. So if they fall apart to those last two games against Leeds and Leicester, they could be right in the mix there too. Everton, I mean, Brighton is their next match, then they play Man City, and then they play Wolves, and then Bournemouth. So you look at those Wolves and Bournemouth matches and think, okay, maybe there's an opportunity there to get some points. But we saw with Bournemouth, right, this past weekend against Leeds United, really convincing victory for Bournemouth, but then Leeds is pretty poor at the same time. And then Southampton, like you mentioned too earlier too, Southampton plays Forest, which is winnable, and then they play Fulham. Again, like you said too, kind of injury hit and without Mitrovic, and then they play Newcastle, and then they play Brighton, which is a derby, and then Liverpool in the last game of the season. So it's all to play for. The three I think will go down are Southampton, Leeds United, and oh gosh, I don't want it to be Nottingham Forest, but I think Nottingham Forest, but West Ham, I think, really have to be really careful. The thing about Everton, Kartik, and you know this better than anyone, right? Everton have scraped by for so many years, narrowly escaping relegation, time after time after time after time. And you wonder if this is going to be kind of the last straw for them, the final nail in the coffin, and if they will go down. Because I think if any club needs restructuring on the field and off the field and having a season to really transform that squad, push players out, bring some new ones in and turn that around and hopefully, right, bounce back into the Premier League, then with a new stadium, I think Everton's the one that needs that kind of recycling.
Yeah, although you could argue the reason they scrape by is because and I'm not trying to belittle any of the other clubs. They're all great clubs. All clubs have fanatical support in England. But the level of support and the difficulty of going into the ground at Goodison, going to Liverpool and facing Everton is unlike any other experience near the bottom of the table. And quite frankly, there are people who tell me it's unlike any other experience in England, right? It's comparable. Folks that have been around the world, been to a lot of grounds, tell me it's comparable to some of the liveliest grounds in South America, to the grounds in Germany. The Bundesliga in general has better crowds, better crowd involvement than the Premier League. And there are former referees who will tell you it is the hardest place to officiate in England, bar none, because of the crowd being on top of you, because of how vocal they are, and the spirit they bring. So that might be worth a point or two for Everton. It was last season, right? It's what kept them up last season. Was I mean, I, of course, waxed lyrically about Frank Lampard and tactical changes and his man management, but the reality was it was their supporters that kept them up. It could be the same thing this season. One point I want to make about this whole relegation fight.
Let me just chime in on the Everton thing. So to me personally, yes, the fans in the past have been kind of the deciding factor. But really, to me, that last game of the season against Palace last year, it was Richarlison that was the difference. So the standout player really saved Everton in that match. But the fans were backing them. However, I think now everything that's gone on with Mashiri and Bill Kenwright and just how disappointing of a season it's been, fears of financial fair play, and just really kind of the disconnect between the fans and the board. I think if they did go to Goodison, and you mean they've got some games coming up, who do you got? Home against Man City or home against Bournemouth at the last game of the season. If you mean they go down 2-0, I can see that fan base at Goodison turning and being even protesting or turning the other way, being more negative than they have in the past. Because I think most of those fans, enough's enough. Time has to change. Something has to change. So I don't think that's as much of a factor as it would have been in even last season.
That's very possible, right? I mean, it's not just Mashiri. They're at their wits' end with the board, some of whom, like Ken Wright, have been around before Mashiri came in. Usmanov, whose money was floating the club, he has been sanctioned by the UK government as a result of Putin's invasion. He's an oligarch close to Putin as a result of Putin's invasion of Russia, of Ukraine. And you have other issues. They were already running afoul of FFP and got a waiver because of COVID before that. So there's all kinds of uncertainty around Everton's finances. The one point I wanted to make real quickly about this relegation fight, Chris, is Bournemouth was a side that most people had picked 20th before the season. If you watch Sky and you listen to TalkSport, they were supposed to be the bottom team. They had a manager in Scotty Parker who said the team wasn't good enough, openly attacked the club hierarchy and got himself sacked the next day. His assistant, Gary O'Neill, has gotten them to a point where they're safe. And not only has O'Neill done a remarkable job, and we're not talking about Bournemouth in this podcast because they are safe, even though they have what is basically a championship squad. It's the same squad they had in the championship that they got promoted with. But they have, I think the key thing to understand when we talk about these other six teams is that the midfield for Bournemouth is really, really good. So even though they were in the championship last year, Tavernier, who they bought from Middlesbrough, and Lerma and Billing, even though those guys were in the championship last year, they're a mid-table Premier League level midfield, which is made everything else where Bournemouth do have a lot of holes around the pitch, and that's why they have minus 30 goal difference or whatever. That's why they're safe right now. So the thing I would mention is that you went right to McKinney, right, with Leeds. These teams we're talking about that are fighting relegation all have suspect midfields, and I'm shocked I'm saying that about West Ham because they have Declan Rice, who to me was one of the three or four best players in English football the previous two seasons, better than most of the guys on Man City that people wax lyrically about, and Arsenal and Man United, etc. But this season he's dropped off. Paqueta has been pretty good, but he plays further forward. Socek had a good match offensively against Palace, but he hasn't been anywhere near the same level he used to be at. So the midfields have been a real concern for all six of these sides, and that's the reason why Bournemouth, with a championship squad, is safe. And we're talking about several teams that have been in the Premier League. Five of these six teams have been in the Premier League for a while that we're talking about going down, potentially going down, are struggling.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, Kartik. And in looking in that Bournemouth against Leeds match from this past weekend, I was thinking something similar too. I was looking at Leeds United and going, hey, this is a championship team. There really aren't that many standout players in that squad that are going to make a difference. And part of that is, I think, Jesse Marsh's, even in hindsight, right, poor transfer decisions, poor signings. Most of them haven't come to fruition. Yes, they've had some injury problems through the season, but that the way that they're playing and the way that they were outplayed by Bournemouth, Leeds looks like a championship squad. So what about the manager though, Kartik? So I know we're recording this on Monday. There's a lot of talk about whether Javier Gracia might be sacked in the next 48 hours, possibly. The Leeds chairman looking at possibilities that kind of he has the final say in whether or not you mean to bring somebody else in. You mean, is it too late? Is it too late with four games to go to eke out some type of points out of the last four games enough to keep them up?
It's really difficult to make the change at this point and stay up. Escobala, who had the job as a caretaker earlier in the season when they sacked Jesse Marsh, he's the only guy I could see making sense if they're going to sack Javi Gracia at this point. Four matches to go. I'm trying to think of a historical situation where this happened, where a manager was sacked this late in the season and saved the club. Now, there were several successive seasons about 10 years ago where Sunderland would sack their manager in March. And one year they brought in Martin O'Neill, one year they brought in Goose Poyet, one year they brought in Paolo Baldacchino, and they would save them, but never in early May. So I think it's too late.
Yeah, you look at Leeds' fixtures for the rest of the season. So Man City away, Newcastle at home, West Ham United away, and then Spurs on the final day of the season. And you look at those four matches, they could maybe pick up maybe 1 point at the way that they're going now, maybe. You mean, so they might end up with no more points for the rest of the season. If they do change a manager, it would need to be somebody, like you mentioned, in terms of on a temporary basis, or someone that you could look ahead and say, okay, well, that person is, even if they do go down, then someone like Brendan Rodgers, if he would stoop so low to go to Leeds United at this point, could work with them within the championship and try them bring them back up next season. So they're in a really tough spot. And honestly, if they get a point from the next four games, that's probably being optimistic, even though it sounds completely pessimistic on Leeds' chances. So this is, to me, this is a really fascinating race. It has been entertaining, as we've seen with that Leicester-Everton game. I'm sure the next game up for Forest against Southampton coming up, I think this weekend, is going to be, it's going to be really, really tense there. And Steve Cooper at Forest under enormous pressure, knowing that, if Forest stays up, he's probably going to get the sack. If they go down, he'll get the sack. But, he's really, really trying hard with the squad he has. And they're still missing, even though they've had all the signings, right, over 20 signings, they're still missing that striker who's going to be scoring the goals week in, week out. So, yeah. Anything else on the relegation matters, Kartik, that you want to share before we move on?
Yeah, I think the really key thing to look at when it comes to West Ham is that they've continued to advance in Europe during this time with relative ease. They're in the semifinals of the Conference League, and they have not been able to use those European matches to create the kind of continuity in the side you would expect because they've rotated so much. So West Ham, to me, like in this Palace game, now granted, Azuma got hurt very early in the match, right? And Albana, who's had some injury problems the last two seasons, came on, and maybe that penalty was really dodgy, right, on Ødegaard. But the bottom line is West Ham, to me, look like a side that have not played together. And even more so than Forest, who brought in 30 guys. And this is a West Ham side that qualified for Europe the last two seasons. So my last parting thought on this is, even though we look at the table, there are 34 points. There are 5 points clear or 4 points clear. You're right to include them in this conversation because they just have not been convincing. I mean, this is a shocking. I think this is probably the biggest shock of the season for me outside of. Actually, I don't think you and I are that shocked about Chelsea. I think a lot of other people are. But outside of the Chelsea shock for most people is how bad West Ham are. And I still thought a month ago, Chris, by this time we'd be talking about West Ham the same way we're looking at Palace and Bournemouth. Okay, they were down there for a while. Bournemouth was at the foot of the table for a while, right? But yeah, they got the results. We knew they had the team. I had said, I guess this was one prediction I got right, which I said 2 months ago, I still thought Bournemouth had a strong enough midfield, like I said on the show, that they would get out of it because they were much worse teams, and I was correct about that. But I was wrong, and I think everyone was wrong about West Ham. I mean, I assumed they'd be at 40 points, 42 points, and it would be a typical, because this sometimes happened with Everton, with Moyes too, where his team started poorly, and then by the end of the season, they were sitting sixth in the table or seventh in the table, and we had forgotten how poorly they started the season. I really thought that was going to be the case this time, and I was saying that privately to people, oh, we're going to laugh at the end of the 2022-23 season and say, oh, remember that period of time when we thought West Ham might get relegated? Ha ha, they were sitting third from bottom. Now we're into May, and they're still one of the teams you mentioned. So that's my biggest point of all. My biggest takeaway is how underwhelming and disappointing they've been and how actually, in terms of organization and structure, they look worse than the teams below them.
Yeah. And with West Ham United 2 against Crystal Palace from this past weekend, I mean, just it looked like they were on summer vacation already. It looked like they, I mean, really, really poor defensive defending, but it did make it into an exciting game. So let's move on to listener mailbag. First up is Joe. Joe wants to talk to us about our last episode about promotion and relegation. Joe says, I enjoyed the podcast with you and Kartik on MLS promotion and relegation. A lot of great points were raised and discussed. I personally do not have the MLS season pass. I have three kids under 4 years old. And Saturday, 7:30 p.m. Eastern time, we are getting the kids ready for bed. Plus, I usually watch a ton of soccer in the morning and afternoon, and I'm exhausted from soccer by the time MLS games come on. I also don't see MLS as a serious soccer league without promotion and relegation. If I were FIFA, I would mandate that they have that MLS has promotion and relegation, and FIFA has the legal authority to do so. Now, Kartik, you and I have talked about this in the past. Probably for most listeners, they may not remember, but I was at a conference, I think SoccerX conference, several years ago, and this conversation came up, something similar to this, where there was a debate on the floor about promotion and relegation. And on the panel was a representative of one of the top soccer agencies in the United States. And anytime this topic came up, he was very emphatic, very defensive in a way, too, saying that U.S. law trumps FIFA law. And he kept on repeating it. It'd come up again. He'd say, okay, U.S. law trumps FIFA law, basically saying that there's no matter what FIFA decides to do, U.S. law is above FIFA, and U.S. law would make sure that these type of things from FIFA that they would mandate would never pass. Do you think that's? I mean, we're not legal experts by any means, Kartik, but do you think that's really kind of just like pushing an agenda, or do you think they actually have that may be the truth in terms of the way that the U.S. legal system works? And
I've heard other lawyers give other opinions, and this also applies to solidarity payments and training compensation. That might be a little more complicated, but I've heard many lawyers who are versed in antitrust law and kind of a law of competition and regulation of business give different opinions. So this is an excuse, but FIFA allows the U.S. to partake in it. You know, if any other federation on the planet were sued as often by stakeholders in the game as the U.S. Soccer Federation's been sued, that federation would be kicked out of FIFA. Their national teams would be ineligible for international competition. Not only has that not happened to the United States, but the United States has been rewarded by being a host of the 2026 FIFA World Cup. So, and that has actually nothing to do with promotion and relegation. I mean, I guess one of the pieces of litigation, which I was actually involved with Miami FC, was a CAS claim on promotion and relegation. But the rest have all been about pro league standards, about equal pay, about antitrust concerns around not sanctioning friendlies, about the dispute with the charitable arm of U.S. soccer. These have all ended up in the court system and been litigated, and U.S. soccer gets away with it. So, yeah, maybe U.S. law does trump FIFA law because FIFA won't enforce its own statutes on the United States.
Next up is Chris. Chris says, hi, guys. I enjoyed both of you going into great detail on the effects, both positive and negative, of pro-rel in the U.S. if it was implemented. From my perspective, I am in total favor of pro-rel coming to this country eventually, even though I support a MLS team in Seattle, and MLS is largely against this concept. The idea of a club in this country working their way up through the leagues to get promoted to the top flight is something that is very appealing to me. However, I can see why MLS is against pro-rel. Pro-rel would make MLS less attractive for new investors because of the risk involved. As a fan of other sports such as baseball and hockey, in addition to soccer, I have talked with fans of these sports who love the pro-rel system and would love to see it in their league someday, because it would eliminate things like tanking to get a high draft pick, and it could be used by leagues to prevent situations like what is happening to the to the Oakland A's of Major League Baseball currently. If MLS were to implement ProRail successfully, I think it would cause the other big leagues in this country to try to do the same, though that there would be massive pushback from owners. Next up is Bob. He wants to talk to us about a few different topics. Bob says, firstly, thank you, Kartik and Chris, for all of your efforts and expertise in continuing to educate and promote the beautiful game in North America. As an American, I grew up with sports and parental encouragement. At the time, my high school in Rochester, New York, did not have American football, though it began during my high school years. Nonetheless, soccer was our big autumn sport, and to brag just a little bit, our Rochester soccer community was big, having not only top summer leagues, but supporting our local Rochester Lancers, who later became the Rhinos, in our nation's top league, even though we had the smallest population of any NASL team, etc. I remember beating Miami Fusion with Carlos Valderrama in Rochester. I proudly recall playing on the Rochester All-Star team in a match just before the headliner of Lancers against the New York Cosmos. When the final whistle blew, our bench was crowded with Cosmos players. Actually, when the whistle blew, our bench was crowded with Cosmos players warming up. I got to be 10 feet within Pelé and Johan Niskins, etc., and I believe Franz Beckenbauer as well, a true thrill for a 19-year-old at the time. The Lancers hosted international matches as well, playing Panathinaikos, Hearts of Midlothian, and Santos, to name a few. It was truly big time in Rochester. Kartik, what's your memories of the Rochester Rhinos or Lancers, and have you had a chance to see them over the years?
I could do a whole podcast on it, and yes, I actually have been to matches at I guess it's now called Marina Auto Stadium or Saline Stadium, the new stadium, a couple times. Pat Urkely, one of my favorite people in the game in American soccer, but I have so much time for the history of Rochester, one of the premier soccer towns in America that has really been screwed up in the last couple of years. MLS Next Pro messed that situation up with the successor club to the Rhinos, which they call Rochester New York FC. Flower City United in Nisa has had to merge with the Syracuse club, but they're continuing to play matches, so that's good. That's one little toe still for Rochester. Rochester has a great indoor soccer legacy too, and the Lancers came back as an indoor team that Soccer Sam owned for a number of years. Also, some of the best coverage of the sport has come out of that area. So I think of Jeff DeVeronica with the Rochester paper. I think of I mentioned Soccer Sam a minute ago in his radio show. Chuck Z and the International Soccer Archives based up in Rochester. So what a soccer town.
Yeah, and just to add to that too, Bob did mention that he says, secondly, as far as questions regarding Major League Soccer, Apple has made it even more difficult to be a MLS fan, as one must buy the whole MLS season pass to watch games. I can watch Premier League, Champions League, and even fifth tier English matches more easily and less expensively. MLS has lost me as a fan for this year anyway, and sounds like it'll be even longer. And that's, I mean, yeah, we've been talking about that for a while. That's the jeopardy, right, of being behind a paywall on a streaming service, which people can access. However, I think the pricing is still an issue. I think the pricing is too high. It'll be interesting to see if MLS and Apple do maybe like a mid-season discount, or if for those people who haven't signed up, maybe for the last 6 months of the season, maybe a special introductory rate. I think they have to do something, because to me, it seems to be that MLS Season Pass has plateaued. I watch it every week. They had technical difficulties this past weekend for the Minnesota game. I enjoy watching it. The soccer isn't the greatest, but now and again, there's some good action. I enjoy watching it. To me now, it is basically a regular kind of every Saturday night, sitting down with my family, watching the games. I enjoy watching it, but I'm just really concerned about the most of the fans out there. Price is one issue, but I really feel that I don't know if anything, Kartik, I think honestly, I think this particular timing of what MLS is like right now is probably the worst timing for MLS season pass, in that the leagues, the games aren't that interesting. There's not a lot of stuff happening in games where you're like, oh my gosh, you should have seen this game, or you should have seen this new player that did this, or the new signing. There's really not a lot to get excited about on the pitch. Now, off the pitch, I think they're doing a great job with MLS season pass and all the technology, and yes, it could be better, but I think just the timing is not in sync. And it really, I mean, yes, they're still pushing on Messi, but I mean, they're offering the least amount of money out of all of the different partners, whether it's PSG trying to renew the contract, Barcelona, if they can come through with what they're offering. Even the Saudis are offering more than probably all of those. And MLS is offering the least amount of money. But you mean if Messi does want to kind of come here for a couple of seasons, you mean MLS really needs him really, really badly.
Yeah, I talked to someone who works at one of the clubs in the league this past weekend, and he was very, very down on the Apple thing. Felt like that they the club he works for had lost fans as a result. And I don't know if that's a feeling among many people who are staffers in comms departments around the league, but yeah, I just was kind of depressed about it and said it made sense from a monetary standpoint, but exposure is now a problem, and that there's a feeling that maybe the timing was all wrong. Maybe you could have done this after the 26 World Cup, but that the momentum that MLS should be having going into that World Cup maybe gets stalled because of this deal. Let's see.
Yeah, just to throw this in too, from about 10 days ago, it was Atlanta United against Chicago on FS1. The viewership for that game was 64,000 people watched that game. So, I mean, I don't think MLS season pass are bringing in massive numbers. So the TV numbers are a concern. At the same time, I don't know, this is going to be really difficult for them. I think maybe we'll do a podcast on that maybe later this week or sometime in the near future about what they need to do, what can they do to actually change things, make it better, if it's going to work at all. So yeah, a lot of concerns there, but we'll cover that in, I'm sure, in a future episode. Listeners, we really appreciate you listening to us. If you do have any questions or comments or feedback on anything we've talked about in this episode, let us know. We have a new way of reaching out to us, and that's through voicemail. So that's 561-247-4625. You can send us an email, and the email address is web@worldsoccertalk.com. Twitter is @WorldSoccerTalk. You can reach us on Facebook, facebook.com/WorldSoccerTalk. And of course, the website at worldsoccertalk.com. And then leave a comment in the podcast section. Kartik, before we go, where can listeners find you on social media and or Substack?
Yeah, KKFLA737 on Twitter, beyondthe90.substack.com at Substack, and also on Substack Notes. Really important. Pushing a lot of soccer content that I'm not putting on Twitter out on Substack Notes, which I think is open to every. I mean, I'm doing it because I'm trying to get the platform going. Those of us who are Substack creators have been encouraged to do that. But I'm getting some subscriptions, it looks like, for our Beyond the 90s out of what I'm posting on Notes. So check us out there. And I will concede that what's happened with Beyond the 90s, it's become heavy on lower division coverage from England, championship coverage, etc., and then also lower division coverage from the United States. But still, we dip our toes into Bundesliga, Serie A, Premier League, and other topics around the game, women's game, etc. So check us out.
Excellent. Good stuff. All right, listeners, thank you so much for listening to this podcast episode. And Kartik, looking ahead to midweek, there's a lot of big games happening, of course, around the world of soccer. What are you going to do, and what should the listeners do?
Enjoy your football.